Okay, so thank you. I wanted to thank the organizers for the invitation, and it's a pleasure to be here sharing some of the exciting work in this effort, this quantum machine learning effort at NASA. I've been leading this effort for about a year and a half ago. I've been a research scientist for about 4 years, but we kicked off this effort trying to explore if quantum annealers can be used for machine learning and trying to overcome some of the bottlenecks. So I'll try to walk you also through some of the developments that we've done. And this work has been in collaboration with Marcello Benedetti, John Rialpe Gomez, and Rupak Biswas. And actually, this paper was just, I uploaded a new version to the archive yesterday, but it was recently published, I think yesterday as well in PRA. So feel free to go for the details and ask me questions if you have any in that paper. And I also show some new results. So just to put it in the context of some of the things that we've seen in the conference. So let me start by saying, what is the focus of our work? So basically, we heard already that there are three different types of machine learning. So we have the supervised, the unsupervised, and the reinforcement learning. So those are the three main types. So our work, actually, we're interested in unsupervised learning. More specifically, I'm going to actually focus in what is called generative models. And let me explain why that is important and what are the differences. So basically, in unsupervised learning, the difference is that you're not giving labels. So that's why it's called unsupervised. And basically, some of the tasks that you can imagine doing with that is, let's say that you have a picture that somehow is corrupted, and basically your idea is that you're going to learn a model of the whole images, set of images that you know of, basically in such a way that if you know the model, in principle, you can ask the question to this model, do inference, and basically try to infer what is the missing piece of the pictures. That's only if you actually happen to learn the model of the data. So notice that here, there is no really connotation to labels or anything. You really want to learn all the structure in the data. So this is a very, very complex task. And as I said, basically the goal is to come up with a learning algorithm that is going to give you a whole representation of all the pixels in the data. So just to contrast this very quickly with supervised learning, that's another topic that a lot of the work in quantum machine learning has also been devoted to this. Basically, in supervised learning, of course, since it is supervised, you're given the labels, and the task is not that much to learn the correlations in the data itself. It's not to learn actually a model for the data. The task is to just to solve a certain specific task. In this case, is if I give you an image, I want you just to give me which label it is. So basically, the probability distribution that you're learning in contrast to the other one is just the probability over the labels conditioned on the information in the image. Notice the big difference. In the other one, you're actually learning the probability or the joint probability of the image. And if you do some sort of supervised with generative, in the generative case, you are interested in knowing the joint probability of the distribution of the image and the labels. So that's a big difference here with this conditional that you see here. So of course, as you can imagine, this task is much simpler than the unsupervised case, and we're gonna go, and that's one of the motivation of our work, why to go there. So the outline of my talk is basically at the beginning, I'm gonna try to motivate why this awkward selection of unsupervised and generative. So just to motivate, why is it an interesting problem? Why do you need actually there to sample from Boltzmann distributions? We've seen this throughout the conference as well. And in principle, why is it possible to do it with a quantum annealer? So that's I think Mohammed did a great job already explaining that. And the other thing that I wanted to share is some of the recent results, actually doing experiments on the device and showing that the device indeed can sample from classical distributions, from Boltzmann distributions, and you can use it, in principle, to do some learning task. So this now actually looks straightforward, but as I was saying, from going from here, from the theory, let's say in 2010, I'm saying, oh, by the way, the device can sample from Boltzmann distribution, to actually doing an experiment showing this, I think between the 5 year lapse, there was really no experiment showing this consistently. And as Mohammed was saying, the Dewey Fox actually were having a hard time trying to get these trained Boltzmann machines on this device just because it's not straightforward completely. So basically, this contribution is just to show the feasibility part. And the last part, actually, I'm going to talk about some very, very recent results also as of a couple of weeks ago, where we show how to overcome what I called here the curse of the limited connectivity in hardware devices. So basically, this is something that we're going to run into in every single quantum technology in the near future. There are proposals for quantum technologies. For instance, in the case of the D-Wave, every single qubit talks to about six other qubits. There are other proposals for the near future technologies that say maybe you can go up to 40 connectivity, but that's it. I mean, in principle, there is always going to be a certain size. I mean, nature needs to be local, and then there is as many connections that you can put in a single box, in a single chip. So basically, I'm going to show you some examples of what was our approach and the new theoretical developments that we had to do in order to be able to bridge that gap between working with devices with poor connectivity or limited connectivity and actually make some progress in the learning if you're actually interested in doing a physical device. So let me start actually just by giving you one slide motivating my first part, is why unsupervised and why generative. So basically, as you can see, the unsupervised part is becoming far more important in the longer term because we have, with a new era of big data, basically you have lots and lots of data, video, audio, images, and basically they are unlabeled. You don't have a way to put humans just to label every single image, every single clip. So basically it is becoming more important, and it's known that it's far more difficult. Basically, it's been pretty much kind of like overshadowed, as some of these papers say, by Joshua Benju here, who is one of the leaders in the field. It's been overshadowed by supervised, by the really high success of supervised learning. But it doesn't mean that actually computer scientists, they wish they could go to unsupervised, do it very well. And one of the things that they think actually could be done is definitely, if you have a way to have an improved sampling, definitely you can make an impact in this area. So basically, I mean, the other thing of why generative models is because we think actually we have a device. It's hosted at NASA. We have this device, it's a D-Wave device that we can play with. And in principle, we know already that we can sample from Boltzmann distributions there. So in principle, Boltzmann machines is an essential piece in making progress here. So that's why we think it's something that we can, in the near term, kind of like reach out. Basically, so my motivation for going unsupervised and generative is just the philosophy that I put in the group and that I share with the people that I work in my team, just that we agree with these researchers, and if we want to see quantum supremacy and if we want to see a quantum technology overcoming classical, I think I'm going to go for the low-hanging fruit. It's unsupervised. I'm going to go where the classical computer scientists are having a hard time. I'm not going to go to supervised just because it's a longer path for me. So that's basically the motivation of why we do the research that we are doing in the group. And let me just tell you an overview of a Boltzmann machine. You've seen this many, many times throughout the days. It's an undirected probabilistic graphical model. But let me just remind you, you have visible units and you have hidden units. The visible units is at the end of the day where you're going to actually encode all the data, all your information. So for instance, each single pixel in this image is going to go to a single node in this visible unit layer. So what is the purpose of the hidden units? The purpose of the hidden units is to capture correlations between these pixels, between the data. So basically, that's what the hidden units are trying to capture. Notice in this drawing, there is something that is on purpose, is I didn't connect the visible units, or I didn't connect the hidden units. That's basically the definition of, when you have that type of a structure, that's the definition of a restricted Boltzmann machine. Of course, ideally, computer scientists would like to have this connectivity all to all. I mean, they wish they could. But the only reason why they had this model as a workhorse is because they can make progress from an algorithmic perspective. I'm gonna show you on that, how they do that. So basically, the model of a restricted Boltzmann machine, actually from the statistical physics community, this is a piece of cake. This is just an Ising model where you see you have some biases. Each one of these H is actually just a spin variable, plus minus one. And this is the hidden units. So you have the visible units. You have some biases on those hidden units and visible units. And you have some couplers that, as I said, they are trying to capture pairwise correlation between visible and hidden units. So that's basically the physics behind this. It's just a simple Ising model in the background. And the whole idea behind this is a probabilistic graphical model. So the advantage that you get by constructing this structure is that notice that whenever I clamp the data, whenever I have a new image coming in, basically all the hidden units get completely independent. They get disconnected automatically. That's the beauty of the restricted Boltzmann machine. Basically, when you condition on the visible units, when you clamp the visible units, your probability distribution is just a product of probability distributions. It's independent. And the same happens when you clamp the hidden. So from an algorithmical perspective, this is an advantage. Why? Because the model at the end of the day that you want to build is, remember, it's a generative model. So you want to model every single pixel and trying to understand these correlations. So the way you do that is you trace out over the hidden units, and then you're left with the probability, the joint probability, only over the visible units. So in one of the talks yesterday, they were emphasizing that these Boltzmann machines, they are in principle the bricks of the of what is called deep belief networks, and that's why we think actually slowly we can transition towards deep learning if we understand this very well. The training method, Mohammed already mentioned this in at length, is basically is you do a stochastic gradient descent. So basically, you have a function that you want to optimize, that is the log likelihood, and basically you just take the gradient. The structure that you get from there is you get these two terms. Notice you get one where you clamp the data and another one where you actually need to sample. In order to calculate these averages, you need to sample over the joint distribution. Joint, here I mean, visible and hidden. That's actually when things, that's the definition. That's actually where things don't become that easy, and that's in some way why computer scientists dropped a little bit Boltzmann machines. It's because they pretty much, calculating this piece of the gradient is extremely, extremely hard. That's the computational bottleneck in the algorithm. This is piece of cake. Why? Because pretty much once you can clamp the data, you just toss coins to actually to calculate the probabilities on each one of these units. They are uncorrelated. But this piece, you really need to sample from the total Gibbs distribution. If you cannot do that, then definitely you cannot move forward. Or you are not estimating the right gradient. Of course, I mean, they made a lot of progress. And actually, this paper was coming from 2006 that gave a lot of momentum to deep learning. The algorithm that they propose as well to make progress here is called contrasted divergence. And we're going to mention about this briefly in some of my results slides. So basically, the way they do is you need to approximate and play some heuristics to calculate these terms. So here is definitely the bottom line of my talk is here is where we can make a difference with a quantum annealer. Here's where we can make a difference with quantum technologies. If we have a way to estimate this term that is extremely hard with a classical device, then therefore we can actually make progress. Estimate better gradients that are gonna allow you to get better models. So that's kind of like the promise of what we intend to do. So let me just, in a nutshell, I think Mohammed already explained in detail quantum annealing, but just for completeness, let me just maybe try to grasp to something that you know most likely is simulated annealing. So in simulated annealing, it was one of these stochastic algorithms that was proposed in 1983 by Kirkpatrick. And basically, the idea was to exploit thermal fluctuations to overcome local minima. So basically, what you do in simulated annealing is you start with a really, really high temperature. And then you start doing an annealing in the schedule where you lower the temperature in such a way that hopefully, if you do this slow enough, basically you're gonna land, you're gonna be in equilibrium at every single time in this Markov process. And at the end of the day, you're gonna actually just be stuck, hopefully, in the global minimum. It's a heuristic algorithm, it doesn't work all the time. But the idea is that you exploit thermal fluctuations. Quantum annealing actually is not that different from that perspective. And let me tell you the difference. So, the difference is instead of using thermal fluctuations, you're gonna actually exploit quantum fluctuations. The idea, notice, that is the same thing. Here you have a term in the Hamiltonian, that is the driver Hamiltonian, is the blue line, is the A of T, where actually, where it's turned on at the beginning and is high. That's basically the transfer field that Mohammed was referring to. You start with this term, and then basically you slowly turn it off, while it's slowly turning on the problem of interest that you want to solve. It's basically the one that is giving you this energy landscape that you want to solve. So the whole idea is that At the same time, quantum annealing is exploiting the adiabatic theorem of quantum mechanics. That is telling you that if you start from an eigenstate, in this particular, hopefully, the ground state of an easy Hamiltonian, and if you turn up the knobs and you slowly move through this time-dependent Hamiltonian, you're gonna hopefully, if you do it slowly enough and if there is no noise effect, you're gonna end up in the ground state of the final Hamiltonian. You're gonna be in the ground state at every single point in time. So basically, the idea of quantum annealing is very simple, is you have a time-dependent Hamiltonian, you have an initial Hamiltonian that you can ramp up, and it's very easy to compute and to prepare the ground state. And basically, you try to prepare, you encode your problem, the problem that you want to solve, you encode it here in HOP. That is just an Ising-like model. If you manage to encode the problem in such a way that the solution to your problem is the ground state of that Hamiltonian, then you're done. Why? Because the quantum mechanics is helping you. Quantum mechanics is telling you that you're gonna end up in that ground state, and you're gonna read it out, and you're done. So basically, that's basically adiabatic quantum computation and quantum annealing in a nutshell. So of course, all the interesting things are happening here in the middle of the schedule, where you have all these quantum fluctuations that is just basically given because H of B and H of P, they don't commute. So basically, you have sigma x here, you have sigma z here. Basically, this non-commutation gives you quantum fluctuations, gives you tunneling, gives you all these interesting effects. So basically, and at the end of the day, hopefully you also land, as in simulated annealing, you land here. So that's basically, in a nutshell, quantum annealing. Now, so let's think, actually, how do we work operationally? I've been working, at least in quantum annealing and in this field for about 10 years. From the algorithmic perspective, from the physics, from the applications. And basically, when we think of using, let's say, a D-Wave device, type of device, we think that the device can do mainly two things. The first one is the one that has been the emphasis over the last 10 years, the last decade, is basically solving combinatorial optimization problems. How do you do that? As I explained in the last slide, basically, you need to map any single problem. For instance, now that I work at NASA, you have a planning and scheduling type of problem. You have a fault diagnosis type of problem. Any problem of interest that is combinatorial optimization in nature, you need to map it to an Ising problem. Once you map it to an Ising spin, voila, you can actually just go and implement it in the device. So this step here is not straightforward, and it requires some research. But it can be done. We've done it for many applications. Protein folding, for instance, that's the one that I did during my PhD. So any application that you can do, you can map it to this Hamiltonian, if it is an NP-hard problem. So also, for instance, just to mention here, in the very first day, we had a talk by Ashish, where he was telling us that in machine learning, you have two flavors. You have the optimization, and you have the integration or sampling type of approach. The optimization approach, actually, for instance, all the previous work from Google that was published along with D-Wave about this card detector, it was precisely in this framework. They were actually solving an optimization problem. So they were finding the best set of weak classifiers, but that was an optimization problem. So now, the other mode is the one that has been explored the least. And I think actually is the most interesting one now that we are doing research on that, because we see actually, now that we understand it, we can do a lot of research here. It hasn't been explored that much, but basically, the premise is that in principle, you can think that the device is solving this one, is this problem, is giving you the lowest configuration, is solving the minimization problem, or you can think that the device is actually sampling from a Boltzmann distribution. This Boltzmann distribution is the Boltzmann distribution associated with this energy function, classical energy function, that you are actually inputting there. So there is a caveat, and it's precisely this point, that is, it is sampling from a Boltzmann distribution with an effective temperature that we don't know, because it's not the temperature of the device. And then, but in principle, if you manage to solve this problem, to identify what is the Boltzmann distribution that the device is sampling from, then in principle you can use it to train Boltzmann machines, or for instance, that's actually what we are thinking in NASA in particular, some application for deep learning. The early work, as I said, that maybe the first time that I saw in the community, the proposal that the device can be sampling from classical distribution, it was this work by the Dewey Fox in 2010, and it was actually, it was presenting that indeed the device, on a very small experiments of 8 qubits, indeed the device, they could fit a Boltzmann distribution. And they realized there, without hinting to what was the physics behind this, that actually that you need to adjust the effective temperature, otherwise your samples don't look like Boltzmann. If you look at the samples themselves, and for instance, let's say you use the device temperature, then your samples are gonna be all over the place. The only way you get a good correlation with Boltzmann is if you manage to identify the effective temperature. The only issue there is that now you see that we turn a hard problem into a harder problem. Now you need to identify, use machine learning to identify what's the effective temperature of the samples. And that was the hard part that actually I think there was no progress between the last 5 years is because coming up with a technique that allows you to extract this effective temperature efficiently and very, very quick is basically what I think it was the missing step. So the algorithm that they proposed there and they claim it in the paper is an intractable algorithm because basically you can extract this temperature to make good fits, but then it doesn't work that well. Then it doesn't work because it's just intractable. It works for 8 qubits, for 60. If you go to larger instances, it won't work. So here's basically, again, if you manage to solve this problem, then you can calculate this type of averages, these pairwise correlations between hidden and visible units. And then in principle, you can use it for unsupervised learning for Boltzmann machines. So basically, that was the contribution of our work. In this work that was published online yesterday, basically what we do is we proposed an online calculation of the temperature, effective temperature, that in principle allows you to make a robust progress in the learning in such a way that you can use the sample directly from the device in a way that you can actually calculate the gradient and then make progress. So our approach is entirely, I think it's a nice feature of our approach, it's an entirely hybrid quantum classical approach. Everything that is kind of like piece of cake for a classical computer, you can do outside, you can calculate gradients, you can calculate all the pipeline of the machine learning effort is calculated outside. Really, the only place that the quantum computer comes is just to get the samples to estimate properly this term. And that's basically, you just feedback, you just get the sample from the device, you feed them back to the classical computer, it does all the work, it calculates the updates, and then you can feedback and then program the device again for the next iteration. So it's a completely hybrid quantum classical approach. And basically, what I'm gonna show you in the results is, I'm gonna show you why it makes a difference to really know how to compute this. That's basically some of the results that I wanted to share with you. Actually, recently, there was also some follow-up work in 2016, just mentioning that actually going in depth about this concept of the effective temperature and how important this is indeed, and maybe some pathological cases where the estimation is not gonna work. So I just wanna also be very, very careful. I'm just gonna say that our approach is the best thing that we could come up with. Actually, Marcello did the master thesis with me under my supervision. We came up with a few versions that they were naive, and I think the most robust version is the one in the archive recently. That's the one that we've been using and that we've been successful. That just to say that indeed, we don't think it's perfect. We don't think it's gonna work for every single problem landscape and for any complicated landscape. It just works the best. And I think you're gonna see at the end in one of my results slides, it even worked better than I think the state-of-the-art techniques from statistical physics. That was one of the requests from the PRA referee, and I think we did that, and we see that it still works better. The nice thing of the technique is that, as I said, you need to get samples from the device to estimate this term. The same samples, exactly the same samples that you're getting from the device are the same ones that you use to estimate the temperature. So basically, there is no waste of resources, or it's not like you need to run the device to estimate this temperature in a different mode or anything. Everything is completely straightforward. So Mohammed already pretty much explained in beautiful detail why you're sampling from a classical distribution. But just, I mean, you can go to our paper, or I think this paper from Mohammed also gives a good intuition. And as I said, this physics intuition only is coming only from last year, or I think in principle we knew because we knew the physics of the device. We knew that this effective temperature is coming from this freezing point. But there is something that I just wanted to emphasize, and that you're gonna see throughout my talk, is one thing that Mohammed didn't mention, is that this effective temperature usually is, for the most part, is always greater than the device temperature. You can see already why this effective temperature is always greater. And it's basically it's because the effective temperature in reality is not coming because the device is changing temperature. The effective temperature is coming because there is a rescaling in the energies of the distribution that you're sampling. Notice that it's way different to have this Boltzmann distribution here, where the gap, the energy states here are more spaced out than actually having the energy states here. This is the eigenvalues. So basically, the energies here are squeezed. And basically, this squeeze, actually, this lowering of the energy scale is basically what is giving you a higher temperature. So basically, this is an observation, an important observation that you're going to see throughout my talk is when we see the experimental results, the effective temperature is always going to be above the device temperature. And there is another neat thing is if you really understand the open quantum system dynamics of the device, you can easily pick up that the effective temperature is going to be instant dependent. That's why this problem was a nightmare. It's because every single time that you program the device, let's say you are doing machine learning. In machine learning, the deliverable to your customer is not much the samples. I mean, when you're doing training, you're varying the H's and the J's. So you're doing updates of the H's and J's. H's and J's define a different instance. And every time you program the device with a different instance, then the effective temperature changes. Why? Because it's a different energy landscape, it's a different open quantum dynamics, the freezing point moves, and everything changes. So I'm going to show you actually some more in detail results about that. Notice that it's interesting. It's really, machine learning is a dual problem because here, the deliverable to the customer is the model. It's the H's and J that best describe the model. In optimization, the deliverable is the bit stream that solves the problem. So in reality, here you're interested in the samples. In the machine learning side, you're interested in learning the model, the H's and J's. So that's a big difference also for you to keep in mind when you see these papers in our field. So let me move on and actually explain the results of our paper. And basically, we really wanted to test and make sure that we were actually making progress. So our first paper, that's why I call it a feasibility approach, is to be very careful and do a small data set where we can actually even compute everything mostly exactly. So we actually took a data set from the computer science community. It's called the Bars and Stripe, but in such a way that it's a small data set. In this case, you only have 16 visible units are these pixels. So basically, if you ask me what the data set looked like, it's just this. It's just bars and stripes, a bunch of bars and stripes, pictures that look like bars and stripes, with bars and stripes. And basically, all these 16 visible units, as I told you, every single pixel, now you're going to see a kind of like a tutorial how to walk you through constructing a Boltzmann machine. Every single pixel is going to be represented in hardware in each one of these qubits. You see, here's my picture, A, B, C, D, all the way to P. And then basically, we're going to map every pixel to a qubit in the device. Notice that the connectivity of the D-wave itself is interesting because it's already more or less bipartite. So every single unit cell, here is a unit cell with 8 qubits. So what you're seeing here is a unit cell of the D-wave device. So you have 8 qubits where the 4 qubits on the left, they don't talk. They don't talk to each other. The ones on the right, they don't talk to each other. So that's pretty much the constraint in a restrictable machine. But there is full connectivity among them. So that's why we selected for this one the visible and the hidden, we can put them here. So basically, there is a caveat in this picture, and is that it's not a full restricted Boltzmann machine. Why? Because you don't have connectivity all to all between hidden and visible. So that's why we call this in our paper, we call it a chimera RBM. So it's a restricted Boltzmann machine, but it's a little bit more limited because you don't have connectivity all to all between visible and hidden. But here is the mapping. And you can run an experiment now. You can just get data, put your machine learning codes to work, and then try to see if you can improve, and you can train a model on the device that is going to reproduce bars and stripes, for example. Here is the results. And as I mentioned, in this particular case, we restricted to a small size in such a way that we can compute every single success metric exhaustively. By here, for instance, one of the metrics that is usually approximated, here we computed exhaustively, is the log likelihood, the average log likelihood. That's the gold standard. That's really what you want to optimize. That's what you want to maximize. So in the y-axis, you're trying to maximize log likelihood of the data and your model. And here are the learning stages. So basically, this is the machine learning at work, basically doing every single iteration, taking steps in these landscapes of H's and J's. So it's basically trying to improve the model every single time. What you see here as a baseline is in blue, the blue squares, is what you would do if you just run simple contrasted divergence once. So that's basically more or less the standard approach in any machine learning, let's say for deep learning or any of these approaches. Basically, CD1 is the heuristic that they use. That's kind of like the cheapest, the quickest, and dirtiest approach, but it works pretty well. Now, you can see actually for this simple model, we can go all the way to CD10. That would be the yellow green, the green circles. And then, as I mentioned in this model, since it is so small, we can pretty much compute what is close to the exact gradient, the exact, remember, there is a term that is very hard to compute. If you do CD100, pretty much you're already saturated and you already converged to the desired result, the exact result. So that would be your target. The other lines that I'm missing, they should be looking forward to match that guy up there. That's the, close to the exact result. Now, where is actually our quantum-assisted algorithm where you estimate the temperature at every single point? Is basically is the one with the crosses. It's the one that is capable of beating CD1, that is capable of overcoming CD10, and is the only one that asymptotically is approaching the exact result. So notice that if you happen to use, so I have to admit that between 2010 and 2015, there were some results, I mean, they were not published, they were just, let's say, in unpublished, for instance. I think Jordi Rose, for instance, he did an experiment where he put in a blog post showing that some of the experiments, you could beat CD1. And there was also another result last year where they were showing that they could also train the quantum device to beat CD1. So I think this is the first result that consistently is showing the importance of temperature estimation. Notice why. If you happen to use an ansatz that is say, I'm gonna forget about this effective temperature business, I'm gonna use the constant temperature. Actually, that was the approach in the paper, in the other paper, is you see that, yeah, maybe you can beat CD1. You see, if you use an effective temperature of 0.08, you can beat CD1. In principle, you don't even know where to start, but let's say that you know that it's larger than the temperature of the device. The temperature of the device here in these units is 0.0333. So basically, you can say, I'm gonna use 0.08. What we did actually here is, we use constant temperature. We use a grid of constant temperatures. I'm just showing you a few. We use one that is below the expected one, one that is much above. This is this one. So you see, basically, you don't learn anything if you use the wrong temperature. And this one is our reference in the sense that I tell you, let's say that I even give you the, let's say that I do the work and I estimate these 5,000 effective temperatures. Let's say that I'm nice enough to give you the average. Use the average. And that's basically, this is this line. This is the red line. Notice that even if I give you the average over the whole training set, still you don't match the performance of estimating the effective temperature at every single point. So this is just to show you that it really has an impact in this logarithmic scale, whether or not you're sampling from the right distribution. And that's why basically nobody had any progress until recently. So that's basically, this is the bottom line from these results. Now, let me actually zoom in this particular region, in this particular region here. So just to show you how wildly this effective temperature is actually varying. So as I mentioned, the effective temperature of the device is 0.033. And basically, what you see is that the temperature actually easily vary twice the device temperature along the training set, even in a small window of 50 iterations or so. So you see actually there is some correlation, and it should be because actually the instances are only spaced. You're doing an incremental step when you move from one step to the next. But notice that this temperature varies wildly. So that's what I was saying. I was telling you is you really need to estimate this temperature, and that's why even if I give you the average temperature, you will not be doing a good job. It's because, for instance, if I give you the average temperature and it's this one, when you are at this stage, then you're significantly dropping your learning performance. So this is actually one of the nicest results that I think the fact that we now, so in reality, all the learning procedure happens classically. By that I mean computer scientists, they don't know about temperature. They only know about weights and biases. Temperature is the ratio, for instance, in the device we are programming H's and J's, and we know that there is a ratio of temperature somewhere. In computer science, the temperature is encapsulated already in the biases and in the weights. So if I want to communicate with my classical code, the missing link is effectively the temperature. So if a computer scientist tell me, I did my training, I use CD1, I'm stuck here in this point. I'm already pretty much plateau. I cannot see any improvement. What the computer scientist is going to give me is a set of W's and B's, biases and weights. The connection between biases and weights is just the multiplicative factor, as I was saying. It's just, I mean, if I, let me put it here. So basically, they give me a weight. Basically, I know that in my device, I just need to know the effective temperature in order to translate between these two quantities. And if I'm given the biases in the classical model that I told you, I know this is going to be my bias divided by my effective temperature. If I know the effective temperature, I can, in principle, restart from the classical model. So I can communicate with them, and I can let the classical computer do the dirty job of overcoming this barrier that is just noise. In principle, at the beginning, there is no information in this learning. You start with a zero information. And basically, at the end of the day, now I can tell the computer scientist, give me what you learned. And then now, since I know the effective temperature, now I can restart from there and keep going with the quantum device. So this is really like a classical hybrid quantum approach. And just to illustrate this, that the only way you can do this is if you know the effective temperature is, notice that naively, if I use the temperature of the device, this is basically what happened to the learning. Pretty much you significantly drop orders of magnitude below what you can even see here. I think it goes the way to minus 14 or minus 15. So definitely knowing the effective temperature is the only way that you can really learn from which sampling distribution you are doing, and then it allows you to do this type of tricks. This is the one that I mentioned. It basically is you can find the details in the paper. Is the referee asked us that we should compare with the state of the art in statistical physics. And basically, we use the statistical physics approach, zero likelihood. That's one of the state of the art ones. And basically, to estimate the temperature. And we see actually that the protocol that we described in the paper that I didn't have time to talk here is basically it still performs better. So that's in the long term. So that's basically some of the results that we put in the new version in the archive. So I think I have how much time do I have? 10 minutes? Okay. So I'm going to actually switch completely to the new results. And I think we're very excited about these new ones because now that we understand this perfectly, now we can be more adventurous. Now we can say, let's say that a computer scientist have a model that is too complex for us to embed in the device. That's basically the issue of what I call the course of limited connectivity. It is very commonplace in principle, or it would be ideal. Let's say that each one of these logical units here, they're pixels. In principle, what is the most complete model that you can have? It's a fully connected graph. In principle, you would like to know which variables are talking to which. And you don't want to discard a priori like which ones are the least relevant. So basically, as Mohammed explained, I mean, with the standard way that we do it, if we want to embed this graph, we need to play some tricks. And it's called an embedding trick, where actually each one of these single variables, for instance, like the zero, we need to replicate that variable in the device, make copies of that variable, basically in such a way that variable number zero can talk to variable number one here, because you see there is a link here in the device. Basically, you see that it's talking to number two, to number three, to number four, to number five as well. I think I always miss one. It's talking to number five here, and it's talking to number six. Let's say zero is talking to number six. Let's see, I'm missing one. Upright, sorry, zero. I don't see number six anywhere. Oh yeah, there you go. I see it now, perfect. So you see, like, in principle, it's not as straightforward. You really need to play with the device, replicate these variables in such a way that you make sure that all the variables are talking to all. And the way you enforce this, that was the question in the session before, is you put ferromagnetic coupler, that's the standard approach that you do, you put ferromagnetic coupler in such a way that you enforce that this variable is indeed the same one. Such as you put a ferromagnetic coupler. That's actually not the approach that we use in this paper. I invite you to go in the details in the paper. Our approach actually allows you to even learn what this couplet should be. Because in such a way, you can actually have a more flexibility in the Boltzmann distribution that you're sampling from. So now, the type of experiments that we're doing recently, now it becomes really interesting. Let's say that you want to embed a real-world data set, let's say with 42 variables, and it's fully connected. Let's say that you want to place that in the device. We did that. So basically, you do the embedding. It becomes of the order of 794 physical qubits. That represents that 42 logical model in a device with limited connectivity. That's what you get. The question is, Can you actually train this? Can you train the device to learn the data of this model? And the second question is, how do you even think of Boltzmann samples from this 792-qubit experiment more or less reproducing the Boltzmann distribution or the data that are coming from this 42-qubit experiment? So those are the things that I really invite you to keep an eye. I mean, this paper should come up in the next couple of weeks or so. But basically, there are several developments that we have in this paper. The first one is answering these questions. The second one that I think is very neat is that we had to develop a completely new theoretical model that is not, I mean, it was inspired by the computer science community. They call it a gray box type of model. It's a gray box model where actually you only need partial information about the model in the background in such a way that you can still make progress. Even if the device is very noisy, you can still make progress. And I'm going to show you the results, only the outcomes of that model. So to do that, I'm going to explain the data set. So the data set is coming from these handwritten digits. They were written by humans, by just coarse grain. Actually, it's coming from 43 people that wrote of the order of thousands of these digits. They are in grayscale originally, and they are 8x8. We cannot embed an 8x8, so that's why we trim it a little bit. We trim the edges, so it becomes now, from an 8x8, we go to a 7, so we trim one of the bottom here, and we trim the two columns, the two edges. So basically, we end up with a data set that is 7x6. Now you see why the 7x6, why the 42. Basically, we wanted to study this data set of digits, and basically, if you binarize this, basically, this is the outcome. So my data set, what I want my quantum computer to learn, or the quantum assisted algorithm to learn, is that if I show him or her these binarized digits, in principle, hopefully, it can give me back, it can learn the model of those digits. And if I ask you, hey, by the way, give me a number one, it will give me a number one. So these are actually just another the representation how the digits look like. So you get used to these images. So this is a number one. That's how it looks like. Number two, number three, number four. So basically, they're more like kindergarten or even less type of digits. But you want the computer to learn those kindergarten digits. And if it is learning that, it's doing a good job. That's our metric. So that's why this is a completely unsupervised learning approach. So I'm going to show you results on this 794-qubit experiments. And the way they assess, there are not that very clear metrics in some supervised learning. They're, for the most part, very subjective. One of those is, quantitatively speaking. So this is one that they used a lot. So this is called the salt and pepper type of test. So you had digits. By the way, this particular digit, number four, number one, number one, number twos, number threes, all these digits are coming from the test set. So the quantum device is not being shown any of these digits. It's only been shown some other training type of digits. And basically, you put the model to a test. The test is, I'm gonna show him now digits that he hadn't seen before, and then I'm gonna corrupt them 50%. I'm gonna remove 50% of the information. If you really learn the model, we ask quantum computer, if you really learn the model, you should be able to reconstruct this image. So basically, we see what happens after one iterations with the quantum assisted learning. Basically, the outcome is completely random. So basically, we go and train the device for one iteration, basically, and everything is still noise, as I said. And as you should expect, now you test the model, you test on this set, and you tell it reconstruct. And it pretty much the model is too poor to reconstruct. What happens is after 100 iterations, now it's doing a pretty decent job. You see, the quantum device, when we ask to reconstruct this image, now it's actually able to reconstruct pretty good digits. I mean, remember, you should be keeping an eye here and there. That's what you want to reconstruct. And this is the corrupted. Of course, it's not going to be 100% because you corrupted the image. So it's supposed to come up with something similar, but it's not like that. And you see, like, after 1,000 iterations or 6,000, it's just really not that much of a difference. So the amazing thing to me, actually, is this was done on a 794-qubit device that was trying to reproduce this 42 fully connected model. And indeed, actually, you see that the model is learning. And we can see, actually, that there is some improvement, and actually in the prediction capabilities. So this is a fully unsupervised learning and generative model on this digit data set. So the final data set that I wanted to show you is another test that I find it very interesting is, let's push the boundaries. Let's go to 46 logical fully connected. And what are we going to do with this 46? I'm going to show the device only when numbers 1 through number 4. So I'm going to need 4 bits for the class. So for that, I need 42 plus 4. And basically, that gives me the 46. And I managed to embed this. in 917 physical qubits. So the experiments are now, that I'm going to show you, is on a 917 physical qubits. Why did I add the 4? Because the test that I'm going to do is different. I'm going to learn the generative model, the full joint model of the data. And I'm going to ask, after I learn the model, I'm going to set only 4 variables, the class. I'm going to set, let's say, if I want to tell the quantum device, give me a number, what you think is a number 1, I'm going to just fit clump 4 variables. If I ask, this is basically what is called a one-hot encoding. If I ask the quantum computer, I'm going to only provide 4 of the 46, and I'm going to tell them, give me a number 2, and I'm going to sample for the remaining 800 variables, because remember, there is an embedding step. I'm going to ask, give me what you think is a number 2. So now, the test that I'm going to do with you guys is, I think is what is called the first Turing test, or the first quantum Turing test. So we're going to have a quantum machine that is going to give you digits, and I'm going to give you digits that are the same type of digits, but they were not used even in the training. And you are supposed to tell me which ones were written by the machine and which ones were written by the human. So here we go. So basically, I mean, the question is, are we capable of training a 917 physical qubit model in such a way that even it can fool some of you? So this is basically what we're going to do. So stare at it for a couple of seconds and tell me if you think if the top row, so here are number 1, 2, 3, and 4, you're supposed to tell me if the top row is the human or if the top row is the machine. So how many of you think the top row is the human? So the human, about half of the hands. So the rest, I assume, think is the machine. Actually, yeah, so the ones that actually lifted the hand, they were the ones that were right, only a handful of those. The digits here, they were just one sample of the device of this 917 qubit experiment. And basically, you see, I mean, they're as crappy as the human digits. So basically, I mean, but basically, if you get crappy digits, the quantum computer to learn, it will learn that. I mean, it learned the model. That's basically, those are samples directly from the test set. So they were not even used in the training. And the nice thing, I mean, it was a fully connected model with 917. The last thing I wanted to show you guys is we wanted to be extremely, absolutely convinced that we are really training this unsupervised model. So we did something that we can calculate exhaustively. And we did this test that is going to be in the paper, is we have a 20-variable fully connected device, 20-variable fully connected model that maps into 128 variables. The nice thing is that I'm going to try to trick the device, and I'm going to try to trick a classical computer that is trying to do the same thing. I'm going to know in advance from this 20-variable model, I'm going to know in advance the model. But then, since I can compute exhaustively, and that's why this is the 20-variable is more or less the limit, exhaustively I'm going to calculate the probability of every single bit string of 20 digits, and I'm going to sample from that. So I'm going to do exact sampling from that distribution. And then I'm going to sample from there, and I'm going to tell, get samples, that's my training set, and I'm not going to tell the classical or the quantum. I'm just going to tell, you go classical, learn the model, you go quantum, and learn the model. And basically we see which one is actually, if they're doing the job of learning the model. We wanted to see exhaustively. Now we can compute everything exactly because we know the model. We have a reference. Here is the gold standard again. Is this average zero likelihood, this average likelihood. And what you can see is pretty much that even though I'm not giving advantage to the classical device, I'm giving the best conditions to the classical device. I'm telling the classical device with simulated annealing, I'm telling you, you go and learn the model in 20 variables. And with the quantum device, I tell him, you go and do what you can do with 120 variables. If you suffer there, it's not my problem. I can still solve this with 20. I'm not going to go to 128. And basically, this is the results that you see. The results from the log likelihood of which one is giving you a better a model of the data, if not very close, actually, in all this region, actually, the quantum device, in some sense, is giving you a better model than even what you would train classically with simulated annealing if you try to train the model on a classical device or try to learn this model. So these are really exact results. Now, the error bars is because we tried actually just to not be biased. We tried 10 different instances, and we constructed the instances in such a way that they had hard landscapes. They are actually spin glass type of instances. The second part is I can compute the exact gradient because since this model is small enough, I can still compute the exact gradient. And what you can see, we were saying, wait a minute, maybe simulated annealing, maybe I'm not optimizing enough simulated annealing, something is fishy here. So we do actually compare with the best result that you can get, the exact one, at least with one learning rate, and you can see actually that even compared to the exact result, the quantum annealer, for some reason, it has a better takeoff. So this is very promising, and I don't want to sell the idea that indeed, actually, maybe there are some quantum effects here or there, no. But there is something for sure that is very interesting that we haven't tested. But for sure, the minimal thing that the quantum computer is doing is that our algorithm, and we have actually a theoretical reason to believe that, our quantum algorithm has an adjustable learning rate. And you can see at the beginning it's learning faster, and then when it needs to slow down, it slows down. And this is because of the effect temperature. So basically, just to show you that maybe you can boost the exact results by adjusting the learning rate a bit, but the fact that we use the same one-to-one condition, the same learning rate for the quantum device, and the same learning rate for the exact model, we still see that the quantum device is beating even the exact result in learning that particular model. So this is, I mean, I think this is very promising. And with that, actually, I would like to conclude. I think I already emphasized this recent work in particular. It taps this new model that we had to develop. It taps into a way to overcome two things, the limited connectivity, and at the same time, the fact that you can work with a noisy device, because it's a gray box type of model. And basically, some of the things that we are doing in the group is, of course, trying to go to more other type of architectures. So for instance, like deep learning. Another thing that we really like to explore is to try to think more like quantum machine learning, even going beyond quantum annealers or more complex quantum annealers. Definitely think of quantum distributions and what they can do actually to quantum machine learning to the field. That's actually one of our main focus as well. And the question that was left here, as I said, I mean, this is our progress in a year and a half. And I think, I mean, at least we now have enough tools to even try to assess if maybe we can reach quantum supremacy in this type of field, or if actually we can do at least better than some Monte Carlo approaches. At least we're showing that we can match simulated annealing. We need to do more sophisticated studies, but I think that's basically the status right now of the team. So thank you.
This may seem far out, but maybe in the future there could be 3D chip architectures to have, you know, like less obstacles to the connectivity you'd want for a deep neural network?
Yes, so actually, well, we have two approaches. So one of those is definitely, I mean, the easy approach is just to get devices with connectivity as much as you can. But I think in principle, one of the questions is more fundamental that we're trying to build is, let's say, what would be the ideal architecture that you need to build? And I think, that's right. I don't think it's straightforward exactly how to build them, but I guess, for instance, you could be inspired by the layer structure of deep nets. So, for instance, you can propose an architecture like that. Or the same, I mean, this fully connected model look interesting as well. I don't think you need fully connectivity. Our work just to show that, let's try the most complex thing just to show the concept. But I think, in principle, definitely this will inspire, as you said, new architectures. Hopefully, that's our intention as well.
This might be a very naive question, but if you think of, okay, we've got a kind of a machine that solves like quadratic optimization problems, and we've got like restricted Boltzmann machines, and they look so similar, although we actually want to solve, I mean, the inverse Ising problem in a way.
Yeah.
When you first started off with that, didn't you actually think, can we use the D-Wave as a device that actually finds the optimum? I mean, the really like most straightforward way? And do you remember what was the problems there that you had instead of going through contrasting diversions and sampling and stuff like that?
You mean in solving machine learning problems with
the
standard approach with optimization, trying to go for
exactly.
the global optimum?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the answer is very simple. It's just noise for the most part. So I think when you're trying to, we face this all the time, and I think it's when you try to do when you have an application where the only thing that you care about is the global optimal, and then definitely I think is noise is what is most detrimental to the performance, I would say, to get there. I mean, for instance, I've been in the community, and for instance, they do these benchmarks where they compare the D-Wave, let's say, to a state-of-the-art codes of simulated annealing or parallel tempering, and they easily do experiments with 1,000 qubits, and the type of experiments that they do, they can get easily one hit in the global annealing per 10,000 readouts, or even 100,000 readouts. 100,000 is the largest that I've seen. In some of the applications that we do, actually, easily you can have instances that it's only a 91 qubits, not 1,000. It's 91 qubits, and you can still get easily a probability of 1 in 10 million readouts. So when you have actually an application, all these issues of connecting properly these units and making sure that it's strong enough that everything doesn't go to the noise level, that's the most instrumental thing, is noise. When you go for global optimization, that's, I think, is the most instrumental thing. That's why I think this is the most exciting thing. It's been the least explored, but I think now that we overcome these bottlenecks, hopefully we'll continue this route. And of course, I mean, we also have interest in expanding other technologies that could actually solve combinatorial optimization as well.
Again.
Thank you.